Here in Iowa, we like to believe that we don't have an accent, but we do have a distinct way of speaking. Today, we'll explore regional dialects and find out about ours. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Aaron Dinkin is a linguist at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. He studies regional dialects. I'll talk with him about how Iowans came to speak the way we do and how language changes over time. Historian Tom Moraine of Graceland University will be here as well. He'll give us some insight on how the people who settled our state continue to shape our language, and we'll talk about our favorite Iowa-isms. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. The way we speak English in Iowa is clear. It's distinct. It's a sound that's often in demand in broadcasting and performance. Some of us like to think that we speak English without an accent. But of course, we do have a distinct way of speaking. We speak in a regional dialect. In this hour, we'll find out how we came to speak the way we do. Later in the hour, historian Tom Moraine will join us. But first, Aaron Dinkin is a linguist at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. He studies regional dialects. Hello, Aaron.
Hi there. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you so much for being here today.
It's my pleasure.
And help me first understand, what is the difference between an accent and dialect?
Well, I say the way we usually use the terms accent is sort of a subcategory of dialect. The way we use the term in linguistics, a dialect is basically just the variety of a given language that's spoken in a given geographical region. So there's the way you speak English in Iowa is the Iowa dialect. The way I speak English is the Massachusetts dialect, and so forth. And an accent is just the features of a dialect that have to do specifically with pronunciation. So different dialects have different accents. That is to say, they have different pronunciations, but they can also differ in things like grammatical rules and vocabulary and so on.
All right. And looking at a map of the United States that has all of these different dialects, all of these different regional dialects on it, it looks to me like Iowa is actually divided between two different dialects.
That's about right. One of the major dialectological fault lines, you might say, in the U.S. is the so-called border between the North on the one hand and the Midland on the other hand, and that dialect border goes back. It's probably centuries old, actually, and it separates. Well, it starts sort of separating upstate New York from Pennsylvania, and then it goes west, separating northern and southern Ohio, Michigan from Indiana, northern and southern Illinois, and then it goes across the southern edge of Iowa. So most of Iowa is in what we would generally call the North dialect region, but the southern edge of the state, including Ottumwa, and as you go west, aiming up a bit towards, as you reach the western edge of the state near Omaha, that would be part of the Midland dialect region, as far as we can tell.
Okay, so let's try to characterize the North dialect a little bit. How would you describe it?
The way we would ordinarily describe the North dialect actually doesn't apply as much to Iowa as it does to other places in the North, which is okay. Kind of interesting. Like the major cities that are east of you guys near the Great Lakes, such as Chicago and Milwaukee, they have a very distinctive accent, which actually reaches from Chicago and Milwaukee all the way east as far as Syracuse and Utica, New York, which involves a lot of really interesting vowel changes. Known as the Northern Cities vowel shift, which I can talk about a little more if you want me to later. But it's called the Northern Cities shift, and because it's mainly affected the largest cities in the northern region. And since Iowa mostly doesn't consist of very large cities, it's mostly escaped this set of sound changes.
Okay, so the way we speak in Iowa is sort of where things started. And we'll talk about how language changes over time as well, and how those changes take place, because certainly I think we've all heard changes taking place within our lifetimes. A lot of us complain about it, but certainly the language seems to be continually evolving. So let's talk about the southern part of Iowa being in the Midland dialectic region. How would you contrast that with the northern?
Mm-hmm. Well, the main distinguishing features of the Midland dialect region have to do with vowels like long O and oo, which are in the north, which are mostly pronounced in the back of the mouth. And this is one of the ways in which Iowa, the northern part of Iowa, does resemble the rest of the north. These vowels like oo and O are pronounced more or less in the back of the mouth. But in the Midland, including southern Iowa and Nebraska and Missouri and so forth, in the Midland and also in the south, as a matter of fact, these vowels are pronounced much more towards the front or middle of the mouth. So instead of something like O, as in boat and goat, in southern Iowa and the Midland region, it's more likely to sound more like boat and goat. Can you hear the difference there?
Yeah.
Instead of O, it's more like O.
Okay, so of course people like to imitate what we think of as a Minnesotan accent, and they'd like to talk like they're a character out of the movie Fargo, right, with the very long O and sort of an uplift at the end of words. and of course not everybody in Minnesota talks that way, but sure, if you listen to the way that people speak in Iowa, if you spend time in northern Iowa, you do hear a more distinct long O sound, Minnesota. And if you're in the southern part of the state, you hear people who sound a little more like they live in Missouri. And that doesn't fall exactly along these dialectic lines that you're talking about. Is there a blurring because of accents and because of environment?
Well, I'm actually looking at some dialect maps that include Iowa right now. And I actually, just before I went on the air with you, I was actually struck by how there does seem to be this sort of shading from a much more northern type of accent in the northern part of the state, like Mason City, shading down into a much more Midland type of accent in the southern part of the state.
Okay, so it is reflected on the map. I've often wondered why southern Minnesotans don't sound like Iowans and northern Missourians don't sound like Iowans.
Well, I mean, I think the reason has to do with the fact that Iowa is located along this this fault line, along the North Midland boundary. So Minnesota is, you know, it's basically wholly north. It's, you know, there's no southern Minnesota isn't really anywhere near a dialect boundary. It's just within this north central type of region. And again, similarly, Missouri isn't really anywhere near a dialect boundary. So Iowa is kind of divided between the linguistic patterns which are associated with the regions in either direction.
Can you help us understand a little bit about where these two dialects that exist in Iowa, where they came from? Who are the influences, or who brought this kind of language here?
This is really interesting, actually. The history of the North versus Midland dialect boundary, as far as anyone can tell, goes back 200 years or more, when parts of the Midwest, when people first started migrating from East Coast communities, East Coast regions, towards different parts of the Midwest. And what you had was people migrating more or less due west. So there was this stream of population movement from Connecticut and New York State migrating west and settling in, well, first central and western New York, and then settling in northern Ohio and Michigan, and then settling in Illinois and Wisconsin, and going on from there. It was the same stream of migration that settled people in most of Iowa and Minnesota. And then south of that line, people migrating from Pennsylvania migrated west and settled in southern Ohio and Indiana and southern Illinois and Missouri and southern Iowa. So the location of this North Midland dialect boundary goes back to these patterns of population movement and migration that got started in perhaps the 1790s.
Fascinating. And of course, you know, the people who came to Iowa and Minnesota and Missouri, many of the people who came here were speaking English as a second language. And, you know, we talk about the Scandinavian influences of language, particularly in Minnesota and in northern Iowa. But of course, we don't speak as if we come from Scandinavia. How does the language change from one generation to the next? I think we've all known families where there's a parent or both parents who have a very strong accent in English from wherever they've come from, and their children grow up speaking like the people around them.
Mm-hmm. And this is basically what children do. The way people learn how to speak their language actually seems to be much more from their peers when they're growing up than from their parents. I mean, so, you know, when
How
you...
How frustrating.
yes, it's been a cause of annoyance to parents for generations, I have no doubt. So what happens, you know, is up until you're perhaps 4 or 5 years old, when your major linguistic models are your parents, because they're the people you hear and interact with most of the time. So up until you're 4 or 5 years old, you'll be basically acquiring the linguistic patterns of your parents and using them as your linguistic models. But then when you start kindergarten, you start school, suddenly you're interacting with all of these other children, and you suddenly have a peer group, which is obviously the group that you belong to, which contrasts with your parents. Right now, suddenly the people that you see yourself as one of are the other children, not your parents, and they become your linguistic models, or the children who are slightly older than you when you start kindergarten, but maybe the first graders become your linguistic models. Because when you're in kindergarten, the first graders are really cool, you know?
Definitely. Well, we have to take a short break, and we will get back to this conversation in just a moment. Today, we're talking about regional dialects and the two regional dialects that are represented in Iowa in particular. My guest right now is Aaron Dinkin. He is a visiting assistant professor at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. In a little while, Tom Moraine, historian who from Graceland University in Lamoni, will be joining us as well. And we want to hear from you. What have you observed as a speaker of Iowan, or maybe you're a transplant? What do you think about the way people talk in Iowa? What are your favorite Iowa-isms? Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm talking right now with Aaron Dinkin. He's a linguist at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. He studies regional dialects. And this hour, we're talking about why we talk the way we do here in Iowa. And Aaron, before the break, we were talking about how children pick up language from their peer groups. So as every generation moves forward, the language continues to evolve and change because kids aren't mimicking their parents, they're mimicking their peers. Do kids also pick up language from media, from television? Or is that part of this peer pressure?
Way less than you would think, as a matter of fact. And I think the reason for this is because generally when you are developing your linguistic behavior in childhood and adolescence, your social motivation for doing so is basically structured around defining your social and linguistic identity with respect to your peer group, right? They're the people whom you're talking to in order to establish the social network that you fit into. So although I think it's possible that exposure to the media can sort of broaden your linguistic repertoire. I think what really shapes the way you end up talking is face-to-face interactions with people that you have as part of your social network.
You mentioned earlier the northern city's vowel shift. Can you explain that a little bit further for me?
Sure, I'll do my best. The northern city's vowel shift is a rearrangement of a whole bunch of vowels that is taking place, or has mostly taken place in, like I was saying, most of the cities in around the Great Lakes. Although I should say on the United States side of the Great Lakes, because in Canada it hasn't happened at all whatsoever. We're talking Milwaukee, Chicago, Detroit, Toledo, Cleveland, Buffalo, New York, and so forth. And it's a really striking change of the structure of some vowel sounds, which have more or less, in most dialects, maintained the same pronunciation for thousands of years, which are suddenly starting to move around throughout throughout the space in your mouth.
So can you give me an example?
I certainly will. So we take the vowel, which is spelled as a short A, as in words like the cat in the hat or trap and so forth. In the Northern Cities vowel shift, this short A vowel comes to be pronounced with the tongue quite high in the mouth, so that it sounds a lot more like the vowel in the word idea. So the cat in the hat can sound, for extreme Northern Cities shift speakers, it can sound like the cat in the hat.
Okay. And so why would this be happening in cities and not across a region?
Well, I mean, so it is kind of happening across the region, although it started in the cities first. It has spread from the cities first to the suburbs and then to rural areas around the Great Lakes. And I think one of the reasons it hasn't spread to Iowa very effectively is just because Iowa is rather far from most of the cities where it's taken place. But the reason it starts in cities, that's an interesting question, and it's probably a result of the fact that just cities, as a result of being cities, have larger populations. They have people with complicated social networks and interactions with a large, diverse groups of people from, you know, different walks of life, different social classes. And so if a small pronunciation change should happen to get started in a city, it has more people who can become exposed to it, and therefore a greater chance of taking off and launching and taking over a whole dialect. Whereas if a small sound change originates with a small number of people in a rural area, there's a smaller number of people who will be exposed to it, and then it has a smaller chance of making it big, as it were. And then it sort of becomes, it feeds back on itself, because once a particular accent is associated with people in a certain city, then this is the way people in the city talk, and that becomes part of the stereotype associated with it. So people in other cities that are nearby have more sort of social incentive to talk that way, and people who are in rural areas have less incentive to talk that way because they've started thinking of it as the way people from the city talk as well.
Interesting. Well, I was wondering about this because, of course, people from Iowa, a lot of us from Iowa, have a great deal of pride about being from Iowa. But when you go out in the world and you tell people that you're from Iowa, sometimes people tend to stereotype you as a hick. And so there are, in my own case, there are words that I grew up saying in a way that kids in the country said them. And I trained them out of myself as I got older because I didn't want to be thought of as a hick. I mean, one of the things that I used to say when I was a kid is, we're going to go down and play in the crick. And, you know, as I got older, I learned that I wanted to say creek if I wanted to talk about that particular kind of body of water. Do you find that there is this shift toward what we consider to be more desirable in this change of dialects over time?
Sorry, could you ask that again?
Do you see that there is maybe a movement toward change in a dialect because of how we want to be thought, not just picking things up from your peers, but people trying to change that the way that they speak, and that might change the dialect over time?
Oh, yeah, certainly. Actually, there's two basic types of language change that we talk about in sociolinguistics in general. And the type of change that I've been talking about so far is what we call change from below. That is, change from below people's level of consciousness. It sort of starts up just among children in their peer groups and so forth. But what you've just been talking about is the other major type of linguistic change, which is known as change from above the level of consciousness. It's sort of the importation of linguistic features such as pronunciations or grammatical structures or whatever that are seen as socially advantageous to have because they're associated with, I don't know, they're associated with admired groups or educated people or even other geographical regions that you want to identify yourself with. A new linguistic feature can enter the community above the level of consciousness as sort of something that educated people want to associate themselves with, and then it can spread throughout the rest of the community from there. The most famous example of a change from above is one that started taking place in New York City maybe 70 years ago or so and hasn't finished yet, which is in New York, the educated and high socioeconomic class people used to drop their R's the way we think of British accents as doing. And, you know, they would talk about Park Avenue. But since the 1940s or so, pronouncing your R's has come to be the
preferred.
Yeah, the preferred, desirable way to speak. And there's all kinds of social reasons for that being the case, but this R pronunciation came into New York City from the top down, and it's now spreading very slowly throughout the whole New York City dialect, so that now people who don't pronounce their R's in New York are thought of as sounding less educated and less refined.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
Well, we have a lot of people who want to join this conversation. I'm talking to Aaron Dinkin. He's a linguist at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. Tom Moraine will be joining us shortly, but let's get to the phones. Rick is on the line from Des Moines. Hi, Rick.
Hi. Good morning. Great show, by the way.
Thanks. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I too grew up with some of the same foibles that you had in terms of crick and wash versus wash. I grew up down by Ottumwa. But what was funny was I was up in Black Duck, Minnesota, doing a nursing in-service, and I saw a couple of the nurses kind of laughing and visiting in the back of the room, and being an old teacher, I said, okay, what are you guys doing? And they came back with, well, we're trying to figure out where you grew up. And they said, we think it's in the South. And, of course, in my head I'm thinking, you know, I grew up in southern Iowa, but they, of course, were throwing out Alabama and Mississippi and all of these southern places because, of course, with their linguistics, they have that little sing-song Norwegian thing going on, and it just cracked me up when I told them I was from southern Iowa. But you hear, again, certain things that, and especially from the standpoint of the dialects, we lived in upstate New York for 3 years in Syracuse, and I fully expected to go to Syracuse and hear New York, the city. But nothing like that at all. It was very Midwestern sounding.
Oh, interesting. Well, Rick, I wonder if your friends in Minnesota had ever met someone from the Deep South.
Well, I don't think they had, because it certainly sounds a lot different than the way I talk. But to them, it was very comical. So,
Rick, thanks a lot for your call.
Thanks a lot. You bet.
Well, I'm so glad Rick said that, because Ottumwa, like I was mentioning earlier, is one of the parts of Iowa that's in the Midland dialect region. And actually, the Midland overall has much more in common with the South than it does with the North as a dialect region. So his Minnesotan friends were onto something there, I think.
Well, and looking at the Midland region, it stretches all the way to the East Coast. And so, again, you're talking about Indiana, which we don't think of as particularly Southern either, and Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. And the Midland, including Pennsylvania and Indiana and even Ottumwa, has this, in particular, it has this feature where the O vowel is much more towards the front of the mouth, more like O than like O. And that feature goes all the way from Ottumwa and from Allentown, Pennsylvania, all the way down through the South.
Very interesting.
The South and Midland are this sort of unified super region, we sometimes call it.
Let's go next to John on the line from Washington. Hi, John.
Hi. I wanted to tell you that everything your speaker is saying is absolutely true. I moved from the south side of Chicago to Iowa and spent a decade learning to speak Iowan. And I don't have the proper vocabulary, but it's the speed of delivery, the soft vowels, and the gentle consonants that make an Iowan an Iowan. And I can pretty well pass most of the time. So thank you for this excellent program. Bye-bye.
Well, and John, wait a second.
Oh, okay.
Did you purposely try to change your accent to sound like an Iowan?
I loved it. I loved the way I was a teacher, and I loved the way my students talked, and I loved the way their parents talked, and I wanted to talk that way. You know, don't swallow the final consonant, as in lamp. Turn on the lamp. It's dark in here. And I had to train myself. And when I go back with my nieces and nephews, I fall behind.
Oh, John, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you. I'm getting back on the radio now. Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, you know, that just reinforces the Iowan idea that we speak correctly, I think.
That's a really interesting connection, actually, the Iowa idea that you speak correctly, because the North as a dialect region in the 40s or so was used as the model for standard English without an accent. It was the model for radio broadcasting and so forth. And then right after that, the northern cities shift started taking place in Detroit and Cleveland and Chicago and so forth. So, well, the funny thing is that people in Michigan still think of themselves as speaking the correct unaccented English, even though the northern cities shift has caused them to depart a great deal from that 1940s standard. But since Iowa is mostly in the north and hasn't undergone that shift, there maybe is something, a bit of truth to the idea that Iowa still mostly has that 1940s standard in many more respects than the other parts of the northern dialect regions do.
Oh, I love it. Thanks, Aaron. All right, let's get one more caller before we go to the break. Toby's on the line from Iowa City. Hi, Toby.
Hello, good morning. What I was wondering about is whether these differences in how words are sounded overlap at all with differences in syntax. When I moved from Philadelphia to central Pennsylvania, the one that struck me the most was switching from car needs to be washed to car needs washed, and that has followed me out here to Iowa. Many people out here also drop the to be, or I guess that's a gerund form or whatever, and I was wondering if this overlaps with the sound differences.
So that needs washed feature is well known in sociolinguistics and dialectology, actually, and it does to some degree match some of the sound features in it geographically. In particular, we think of that needs washed as mostly a Midland syntax feature. So it has, in some respects, a lot of the same geographical boundaries as the Midland pronunciation features. So it exists in Pennsylvania, although, as you say, it doesn't go all the way to eastern Pennsylvania. It starts up in central Pennsylvania and basically extends west from there through the Midland region, central Ohio, central Indiana, and so forth. And then once it gets further west than that, it starts, I believe, spreading out a bit more into regions a little bit further north and south than the Midland is usually thought of as doing. So I'm really interested to hear that Needs Washed exists in Iowa, because I wasn't aware of that already.
It does. And that funny, when we were talking about this show, we brought up that because I grew up saying that myself, and I wasn't even aware of it until I was in college. And now I hear it. My mom says it, and it does seem to be fairly common in Iowa. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back. Aaron Dinkin will stay with us. He's a linguist at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. He studies regional dialects. And historian Tom Moraine of Graceland University is going to join us in just a moment as well. You're welcome to join the conversation also. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, or you can post on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about the way we talk in Iowa. Aaron Dinkin is here with us. He's a linguist at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. He studies regional dialects. And joining us now is historian Tom Moraine. He's the director of government relations at Graceland University in Lamoni. He's also the former head of the State Historical Society of Iowa. Hello, Tom.
Good morning.
Welcome back to the show.
Did I say that correctly?
I think you sound great. It's made me very, very self-conscious talking about this today, about the way I speak. Tom, you can actually identify some physical markers that can show us a sort of a line of demarcation as far as these regional dialects go. You point out Highway 34. Explain to me why you think that's a dividing line.
Well, Highway 34 goes through the bottom two, or the second tier up from the Missouri border. Historically, that was settled by Southerners coming up from Missouri or coming up from the Ohio River Valley, and we're part of that Midlands group that you've been talking about already. Those bottom two tiers of counties. Highway 34 is just sort of rough indicator of how that settlement first began, and so identifying that as a marker, I think, generally works.
That's interesting, and Tom, of course, you're down there, pretty close to the south. There is a real line of demarcation. There is a real difference between people with the way people speak in southern Iowa.
There really is, and in fact, though crossing the Iowa border into Missouri, if you get very far away from the interstate, moving away from the interstate 5-10 miles, to us, it sounds very southern. Now, it may not be, we may sound southern to northern Iowans or to Minnesotans, but to our ear, there is a stronger southern accent that picks up even 20 miles south of here.
Now, you also point out another dividing line, and that's Highway 20. What is Highway 20 the dividing line for?
Well,
of course, that's up north.
Yeah, Fort Dodge, Waterloo, Dubuque, Sioux City, sort of across there. The northern part of the state had a heavy Scandinavian accent. We're with Minnesota, Wisconsin, those areas, and the Scandinavian accent is still noticeable up there. I remember being in a session when Norman Borlaug and his sister and some other Cresco residents were together in a meeting. I was there because they were wondering if the Norman Borlaug birthplace ought to be made into a museum, and it was fascinating to listen to this conversation, because while they were using English words, the tempo of the speech was not what we normally hear. And then
you'd get to the, someone would speak and you'd get to the end of the sentence, and when they were finished, everyone would nod and then someone else would speak. But it was a very structured dialogue, a very polite dialogue, and the rhythm was decidedly Norwegian-Scandinavian. It was like you were hearing Norwegian using English words.
Oh, fascinating. Well, and there are also language changes, other kinds of language changes across the state. And this isn't dialectic necessarily, but these are what I would call Iowa-isms. Can you talk a little bit about some of the different Iowa-isms that you would hear in the North versus the South?
Well, I'm not sure I can differentiate northern and southern Iowa. That's sort of like trying to determine the sex of turtles. To the turtles, it's very important, but I'm sure outsiders might not be able to tell.
Right.
One I do notice, though, my aunt taught kindergarten in Des Moines for decades. She was in a meeting once. There was a speaker, a linguist, who said, "What term did you use when you were growing up to say, 'I'm tired'? What sort of references?" And she raised her hand and said, "We might have said, 'I'm bushed.'" And he looked at her and said, "I'll bet you were Scandinavian from southern Iowa." And her mouth kind of dropped because our family was Norwegian, and she had grown up in Lamoni, which is a stone's throw from Missouri.
Right.
And she said, "That's correct." And he said, "In Scandinavia, the fields were divided by bushes. The hedges marked off the fields. And when you were tired, you went over and lay in the shade of the bush. So you were bushed, meaning you were stretched out in the shade of the hedge." And it was a Scandinavian reference going back to their farming days, their farming heritage. But he got it right off, and he was 100% correct for her.
Oh, that is fascinating.
I have a phrase, a reference, if I could share it. Michael Carey came to the University of Iowa from New York City and wrote an essay. He was in the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and he wrote an essay about listening to Iowans speak. I have a paragraph that I think would be very interesting. Can I share that for a minute?
Sure.
He's talking about when his Iowa-to-be wife first went to New York City and met his family. And he says, "At home in my family, we couldn't be sure if anyone was listening if we didn't grab them. We sat close to one another and talked in each other's faces. I will always remember the first Christmas my wife-to-be came home to meet the Carey family. Kelly said very little. She just kept nodding her head and listening, nodding her head and listening with this mysterious smile on her face. My aunts and uncles were completely baffled. No one could figure her out. It was a compliment around the house I grew up in to interrupt someone while they were talking. That showed the speaker that you were so excited by what she was saying that you just couldn't hold yourself back. The whole family talked fast, closely, and in a loud, excited fashion. Christmas dinner must have sounded like mayhem to Kelly. Everyone was trying to be polite, so she never got a chance to speak and didn't know enough to butt her way into the conversation. To my family, this meant either that she was mentally deficient or couldn't hold her own in conversation, or that she had something up her sleeve. She must have an angle, they thought. She is obviously being disingenuous. We aren't all that pleasant. Why is she smiling all the time? Everyone knows life is difficult. It just isn't right for a sane person to smile for that long. Finally, her sincerity and intelligence came through, and my aunt called me over and whispered to me in confidence, 'Michael, your girlfriend, she's just nice, isn't she?' I could tell from the way she said 'nice' that she wasn't used to using that word as a compliment." And it seems to me that it was an insight into what Iowans aren't. And sometimes we think of that urban conversation of the fast and interrupting as we would attach rude, but in fact, for them, it's showing interest, where in Iowa, the politeness in conversation, the slower pace is I don't know if that's included in linguistics, but one of the earlier speakers mentioned the speed with which we talk, And in Iowans, I think particularly the rural Iowans that he was listening to, because he started farming, Michael Carey, it's a much slower tempo, and it is, he talks about, in Iowa we have space around us, and he says our language has space too, that we don't, we aren't in each other's faces.
That is so interesting.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting comment.
Aaron, can you weigh in on that? Does the speed with which we speak and interact, does that play into these dialects at all?
Well, speech speed is a notoriously slippery thing to get a handle on and actually measure, because there are so many different variables that you have to account for. How many syllables do you say per second? How long do you pause between things? So I'm not sure how much research has actually been done on speech speed by dialect region, just because it's so hard to get a handle on. But I'll tell you one thing, it's something that everybody has an opinion on. And studying people's beliefs about dialect differences can in some cases be just as interesting as studying the dialect differences themselves, like learning that people from Michigan think they speak the most standard English in America, for instance.
That is very interesting. Let's get back to the phones. Cheryl is on the line from Des Moines. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, good morning. I was listening with interest because, for one thing, I am on grew up on Highway 34 in Sheraton, Iowa. And I have a joke that, because I talked to a lot of people, when I was, for 10 years, I was a customer service representative. And to some people up north, I talked slow, and to people who further south, such as down in the Ozarks, I talked fast. But I joked that I was from the south, southern Iowa, because that is true. And then I did notice on the pausing that's all through that the previous speaker was talking about, and being polite and nodding your head and that, and just trying to be nice. But when I worked for the customer service agent that I did, we were told many times that the reason we were chosen was because we had, quote, unaccented English, although I know there's not quite such a thing, but more standard English, I think, than many of the other places. So maybe Michiganers were just not as correct as we were. I don't know.
but I think that does bring up a point. I mean, even if we don't speak correct English, the dialect that we speak in Iowa is easy to understand, I think, for a lot of people. Aaron?
Yeah, I think it has relatively few unusual features. That is, there aren't that many dialect features in Iowa that are very out of the ordinary, the way the northern city's vowel shift is, or the southern drawl is, or the various features in New York City or Boston or Philadelphia. Are features that are sort of distinctively specific to their own communities. I think Iowa does share a lot of features that are easy to understand to a lot of parts of the country.
Steve in Dubuque is on the line. Oh, I'm sorry, Tom, you wanted to weigh in on that?
No, let's take Steve.
Okay, Steve in Dubuque is on the line. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I just have a couple of quick observations, and then I'll take my answers off the air. But one of them, a couple years ago, I was up at the northern border of Minnesota for 2 weeks, and I was with the locals for 24 hours a day for 2 weeks. And I found myself at the end of those 2 weeks, I was already starting to speak like them. And I thought that was pretty funny. And then my other observation, living here in Dubuque, I think I have quite an ear for various accents, and I may be totally mistaken, but I think there's a Piasta accent and an East Dubuque accent, and those two towns are only 5 miles away.
Oh, that's really interesting, Steve.
What's the ethnic background of Piasta and East Dubuque?
Steve, do you know? What are the ethnic backgrounds?
Is Piasta Irish or German?
It would be both. It would be the same type of people that are from Dubuque. It's only 5 miles away, but I feel I can hear a difference in the way that the people that have lived out there for a long time speak from the people in Dubuque.
Okay.
Well, that is interesting. We got a tweet from Jason in Des Moines. He said, I can do you one better. People from different parts of Des Moines have noticeable accents and characteristic idioms. Aaron, do you think it breaks down that in that small a way?
I think not very often geographically within single communities like Dubuque. I think it's previously been found that a lot of the times what people think are geographic differences between different parts of a city linguistically actually turn out to be, well, as Tom was saying, either ethnic differences or socioeconomic class differences, which can sometimes be even greater or more important than regional differences.
Well, and Tom, Steve was saying these towns are only 5 miles apart, but in Iowa, a town 5 miles from another town could have been founded by a completely different ethnic group, right?
But, yeah, that's certainly true. And actually, when I was doing some research in upstate New York, and I certainly found sharp differences in a few cases between towns that are only 5 or 10 miles apart because they were founded by different groups and at different times. So that it's certainly possible that that Piasta and Dubuque can be different in that way. And I just want to throw in Steve's pronunciation, with Dubuque being right on the Illinois border, I'm pretty sure I could hear some of those northern cities shift vowels creeping across from Illinois.
Oh, see, now one of the reasons I came back to Iowa from Michigan was to escape those with my children. So, Tom, did you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I'd add on a historical note. Up until World War I, Iowa was really we weren't a melting pot. We were I like to describe it, a vegetable soup with the vegetables still identifiable. We had different communities had very strong ethnic loyalties, and they would tend to be settled by particular communities. Up until World War I, those communities could be separate and distinct and maintain that ethnic identity. The Model T Ford greatly increased inter-community activity, but also World War I with the anti-immigrant sentiment that anyone who isn't talking basic English is unloyal to the United States. William Harding's edict saying it's illegal to speak any English or any language other than English put a real crimp in the popularity and the reliance on other languages, and resentment that somehow we can't be loyal if English is not our first language, that carried over. We had a lot of newspapers in other languages, and those could exist as long as there was a core community that spoke that language. But then after World War I, those community boundaries started to disappear.
That is fascinating. Tom, thank you so much for being with us today.
I have one quick question. Is the term a whole nother something, is that a local Iowaism, or is that widespread? Rather than another whole something, we sometimes say a whole nother.
That's basically everywhere.
Okay.
Right.
So if I circle that on my freshman English papers, it's not just Iowans that I'm getting, it's everybody.
I think that's right.
All right. Tom,
I feel better.
Thank you so much. Tom Moraine is the Director of Government Relations at Graceland University in Lamoni. And Aaron Dinkin, thank you.
It's wonderful to talk to you, Charity.
Aaron Dinkin is a linguist at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Sarah Bowden, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Caitlin Fry. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, it's Horticulture Day. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.